Today on Maine Calling, the fall bird migration. This time of year, many people head out to catch the fall colors in Maine. But for others, it's all about the birds. Right now, millions of birds are passing overhead as they make their way south. They are migrating from spots in Maine, in Canada's boreal forest, to Florida, Texas, the Caribbean, and even South America. Pay attention, and you might see an unusual species, even in your own backyard. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we check in with two Maine-based bird experts for an update on this year's migration. We'll discuss prime locations for bird watching, what kind of species have already been spotted, and how Hurricane Helene is affecting this year's migration patterns. Have you seen any unusual birds this year? Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by support from Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch and Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth. From investments to trustee services, more at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. All sorts of birds are active this season. It is fall migration time. We're going to find out what to look for and where to go. We're also going to discuss the decline in the bird population and how to help with conservation efforts. Joining me for the hour, Adrian Leppold, ornithologist and wildlife biologist with the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. She is director of the Maine Bird Atlas, a ginormous project. And Nick Lund is with us, advocacy and outreach manager with Maine Audubon. He runs the Bird Safe Maine program, and he writes and blogs as The Birdist. He's the author of several books, including American Birding Association Field Guide to Birds of Maine. We invite you to join the conversation. What have you seen this season? Have you done things to make your home windows more bird-proof? What do you want to ask our experts? Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post a comment on Facebook or Instagram. Welcome to both of you. Adrian, I understand you've lost your voice recently, and so thank you for joining us. We will try to let you rest your voice between answers. I appreciate you being here. But I'll start with you, Nick. Would you describe to people what's going on? Because, see, a lot of this is happening right after we go to bed at night, or at least after the sun sets. And we may see, oh, yeah, you know, it does seem like there are a few more birds at the feeder, but we really have no idea of the scale of what's going on above our heads at night, right?
Absolutely. It's actually really crazy. Birds prefer to migrate at night, especially small songbirds, because it's generally calmer and there's fewer predators around. They can use the stars to navigate. And so every time we go to sleep, September, October, millions and billions of birds across the country are taking off at once and flying as far south as they can. And so every morning when we wake up, there is a new, you know, shift change of birds in our backyards or anywhere we go. And that's bringing, you know, new birds into our area that may not be here other times of the year, and just mixing things up. It's a really exciting time to be a birder.
Right. So you say morning because they've been migrating all night and then they've decided where to settle for the day to nap during the day. And so that's when you might see most likely to see unusual birds right now, right?
Right. Yeah. And they don't really decide. They sort of migrate as far as they can at night. You know, they don't have a map. They don't have a watch. And so once the dawn comes up, they sort of come out and they are wherever they are. Sometimes that could be in a park or your, you know, nice backyard. Sometimes that could be in the middle of a city like Portland. And so you see birds in places that they don't necessarily want to be or choose to be, but that's where they are. And so they have to find food and safety throughout the day and wait for another nightfall.
Adrian, you were going to jump in.
I was just going to add, again, apologies for my voice. I feel way better than I sound. But One cool thing people can do is if you step outside after dark and you just listen really closely, our nocturnal migrants communicate with each other as they're flying, and they give these flight call chip notes. And so it's really cool if you have decent hearing and you step outside and listen closely, you'll actually hear birds talking to each other as they fly overhead. Keep in mind, many times, especially if there's not, you know, low ceiling and low visibility, this migration is happening at 1,000 or more feet in the air. So they're really high up there, but you can kind of witness it yourself with your ears often.
I was lucky enough years ago to do a story with Jeff Wells, and he was recording birds chirping after they took off after dusk, and he could identify which birds by the chirp. I was feeling lucky just to hear anything at all, but it's a very faint little chirp, chirp, chirp that's going on up there. Very cool. So I have to ask, because we know that when birds are migrating, there are birds that are not living here, that their birds, maybe they're coming from the Canada's boreal forest and ending up someplace like Ecuador, but they're stopping in Maine for a day or two. And I'm wondering, Nick, anything unusual spotted so far this year, this fall?
Yeah, so this point of the season, we have millions of those migrants coming through, and a lot of them are exciting, not because necessarily of their, you know, rarity as vagrant birds, like you may have heard of for the Stellar Seagull, but just because they're not birds that we have, say, in southern Maine often. So just this morning, there's a banding station, River Point in Falmouth. They banded a gray-cheeked thrush, which is a rare thrush that I've never seen in Maine. Birds like that, also the boreal migrants that you mentioned, yellow-bellied flycatcher or magnolia warbler. These birds that may not live in our backyards but live in northern parts of Maine or in Canada are moving through right now. We're seeing a shift. So this is, you know, September 27th. This is like really peak migration. And what we're really seeing is a shift in basically, the way I think about it is birds that need to eat insects have to sort of get out earlier. So a lot of these warblers and things are September migrants. We're moving into a sort of changing of the guard into sparrows and other birds that eat seeds and can last a little bit longer in Maine. And so we're going to see a real shift from warblers basically into sparrows as we move into October. And so that's something to look out for as we move ahead. And then once November comes, then it's real what we call rarity season. This is when all the birds that, you know, got lost or getting lost right now and going the wrong way may show up in Maine. It just takes a while to get here. And so that's when the excitement really begins in terms of rare species not supposed to be in Maine at all.
All right. So that's when all of you get are communicating with one another, looking at the blog, seeing what other people have spotted. Adrian, every single time we do a bird watching show on Maine Calling, somebody wants to make the point that we ought to be keeping our cats, our house cats, inside because of all the birds that are massacred by cats every year. And it's a really, I know my husband is personally really passionate about this. And I understand you have a new twist on this bit of advice. So what is it you want to tell us?
Thanks, Jen. Well, it's hard because oftentimes it comes up in the like fast-paced part of the questions. And so I thought it would be, I'm glad you brought it up early on. I've been studying birds professionally for 25 years. I have a PhD in ornithology from the University of Maine. So let me just get on my soapbox about it now. We'll get it out of the way. Unless your cat is disabled, when you open that door and let it roam free, it is negatively impacting birds and contributing to cumulative effects at the population level, the number one source of mortality for birds in North America. We all make choices every day, right? When you, unfortunately, a lot of people choose denial when it comes to this topic. Just because you do not see your cat catch a bird, doesn't mean it's not happening. Cats are opportunistic. For those open to accepting this as the problem and willing to hear this, realize when you open that door, you're making the choice of convenience for yourself over the welfare of birds and wildlife. There are many ways cats can be happy, but it does take effort and attention on our parts. And the twist is this. Let's separate, there's lots of different angles to this. Let's separate feral cats and barn cats. And I'm just talking about our pet house cats. The whole concept of them being natural or native predators. Think of it this way. If it's a natural predator, it's an animal that should be subject to the same pressures and forces of nature. So they should be having to find food, avoid their own predators, avoid inclement weather, and find shelter from the elements. Our pet house cats are at an unfair advantage because they don't have to have any of those same pressures. When we let our pet house cat outside, they're well fed, they have shelter, and they have safety from their own predators. So I just wanted to also leave you with this little story in relation to migration season. And as Nick was saying, our birds are making these long distance journeys and oftentimes end up places where they don't really intend to be. So I used to work at a place in southwestern Pennsylvania where we captured birds and we banded them for research purposes. We banded a sparrow one spring season in southwestern Pennsylvania. The following day, it was recovered in Massachusetts, having flown and made an over 450-mile journey in a single night. And that bird was recovered because somebody's pet cat brought it in. So that bird, after flying that distance to just try to get to its breeding grounds, completely exhausted all of its energy resources, was at a complete disadvantage and captured by somebody's pet cat. So it's a real problem. And I just want people to think about that before they open the door for that convenience of letting their cat outside.
I'm guessing, and I know you're about to lose your voice, Adrian, that, you know, it used to be that people just let their dogs out. And now most people take their dog for a walk on a leash. And you would like to see it more normalized that to use leashes with a cat.
There are lots of options. There are catios, there are leashes and harnesses, there are backpacks, strollers, you know, those. There's some far-fetched ideas, but there's lots of alternatives and resources out there. I would definitely encourage people to reach out to Maine Audubon for help and guidance. Look up American Bird Conservancy. Has some great online resources about how to make outdoor cats happy alternative indoor or trained cats.
We'll go to Christopher, who's calling from Booth Bay Harbor. Hi, Christopher, go ahead.
Yes, hello, thank you for taking my call. So as Nick mentioned a little while ago, my comment and or question is regarding Stellar Sea Eagle. A year or two, possibly 3 years ago, I was lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time in Edgecombe, Maine, and the Stellar Sea Eagle was being seen in and around Arosic in the area at that time. It flew over me, not 5 feet above me, five, maybe 6 feet above me. Closest can be, I saw it, I was in awe, and I was actually scared. I called into your radio show. I think it was the very next week as you were discussing it with the panel or, you know, experts. And someone on your panel discounted what I had said, which is fine because I didn't get a picture. However, I'm curious to know now if that Stellar Sea Eagle has been in and around Maine this year. Has anybody seen it, or is it no longer a thing?
Nick?
So the Stellar Sea Eagle is alive and well, but it is not in Maine. It has been in Newfoundland for the past 2 years or so. And I just checked right now, the last sighting I see from this Newfoundland tour group that does a tour of Trinity Bay up there was September 18th. So still growing strong, looks great and healthy. The bird does move seasonally, and folks in Maine sort of wait every fall and early winter to see whether it may come back. The past couple of winters, it stayed in Newfoundland. But birders along the sort of, you know, mid-coast there should keep an eye out this winter.
I'll just add, I have an inquiry in with my colleagues who are running the Newfoundland Bird Atlas. But as for breeding behavior, the cool thing this summer that was documented is the bird was photographed carrying a stick, which is an indication of nest building. Whether or not it's hybridizing with a bald eagle, we're not sure yet. But it, as Nick said, it seems very alive and well.
All right, Christopher, thanks for your question. Calling in now, Dan Gardoki, who is running an organization called Lead with Nature. He's a registered Maine guide, certified wildlife tracker as well, and calling in from Monhegan Island, where he's leading a birding adventure. Thanks so much for taking a moment to call in, Dan.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Seems like Monhegan right now is the place to be for birders. Why is that?
Yeah, so Monhegan's, you know, is a very special place with a long history of attention to birds and attention to a lot of detail and beauty of this place through the artist communities as well. And it happens to be during the spring and fall, especially interesting with during migration kind of periods. So that's a lot of birds kind of find this little port in a storm. It's, you know, just 10 miles ish offshore here off in Skunkus Bay. And it tends to be a safe place for a lot of birds to land and spend some time and feed and refuel on their long journeys.
What are you seeing right now on the Lead with Nature tour that you're leading? Have you seen anything good?
Oh, it's all, we're easy and we love just spending time with birds, whether they're common or rare, to be honest. But rare ones always get a little exciting. And I just actually had to peel myself away because we had this bird called a yellow-breasted chat, made a really nice showing, and our group had never seen one, well, most of the people, so they were excited to spend some time with this bird. And we also just had a beautiful, a bird a lot of people know from their feeders, the rose-breasted grosbeak. And we're used to seeing that bird in the spring, and the male's very stark black and white with a beautiful red kind of like a crevasse kind of going down its chest. And but this time of year, it's very different looking, and really it's very subtle kind of peachy reds on the breast. It's quite beautiful. But there's all sorts of birds, lots of birds of prey out here. We've got lots of all the merlins and peregrine falcons and sharpshin hawks. And there's a lot happening.
Okay, well, so we can't let you go, of course, without a bird call, because I understand you are especially good at imitating bird calls. What are you going to demonstrate for us today? I'm putting on the spot.
Oh, boy. Haven't thought about that. Well, I was just watching these young goldfinches begging to their parents a lot. So we usually think of goldfinch as a great feeder bird. American goldfinch has this kind of like, and when they fly over often, it's like, you know, but these little begging birds, these little baby birds are kind of doing this and fluttering their wings in front of the parents and just incessantly following them around, and which kind of makes sense because they're one of the last birds to breed of our songbirds here in Maine. So many of them are, you know, somewhat recent fledglings, and they still don't think they can get their own food. So they're getting them all day long.
Oh, my goodness, Dan, you really are good. That's great. How did you learn to do that?
Well, God bless the patient adults in my life. I always was a mimic. I mimicked all sorts of sounds. So when I started to learn birds as a teenager, it was an easier way for me to remember them than using like books and written words. Just sounds work for me. So, yeah, I just started mimicking the sounds I heard when I can.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so I have to ask you, because I awaken most mornings to a family of crows having their morning meeting. I want to know if you can do a crow. That was excellent. Excellent. Thank you, Dan, so much for calling in. Dan Gardoki is with Lead with Nature. He's on Monhegan Island right now with a birding trip. And we are going to take a break. We're talking about the fall bird migration and birding in Maine. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We're talking about birds today, and we welcome your questions for our bird experts. My guest, Adrian Leppold, an ornithologist who leads the Maine Bird Atlas, and Nick Lund with Maine Audubon and the blog The Birdist. He is the author of American Birding Association Field Guide to Birds of Maine. Join our conversation 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. If you all are just joining us, Adrienne Leppold is okay. She just had a little laryngitis that she's recovering from, so has an especially raspy voice today. We're going to go from Emily to Emily calling from Brunswick. Hi, Emily. Go ahead.
Hi. I was just calling in response to the discussion about cats and ways to let your cats get outside without letting them roam free. We put in something that my husband found on the internet called the perfect fence. You can imagine how that's spelled. And it creates an enclosure in the yard, and we have a cat door going out to it. We've sort of rewilded a section of our backyard and made it the area for the birds, I mean, for the cats, and birds don't go into it. I'm not going to say the cats have never caught a bird in there, but very rarely, because the birds see the cats and they don't go in. And so it creates a real area besides just a little patio for the cats to be outside, and they come and go. They don't even try to go out the regular doors anymore because they're so focused on going out there. And it creates a really wonderful way to kind of get both sides of that, give the cats some autonomy, but not let them roam the neighborhood. No bird would ever nest in there, and they don't hang out in there. There's no feeders anywhere, so they really don't go into our enclosure. And so we have found it to be a really good way to let the cats out but protect the birds.
Emily, does the enclosure have a ceiling? Is sort of like fencing?
No, it doesn't have a ceiling. It doesn't. It's got sort of a penitentiary-like fence, around the edge. So that's why I say birds could go in, but they just don't go in. It's not perfect, although it's called itself the perfect fence because it's marketed that way.
Yeah, Emily, thanks for calling in. Adrienne, you're nodding. You've seen this?
Not that particularly, but I really appreciate the caller because it's an example of like there's lots and lots of different alternatives out there. And I mentioned another one is this is not an ideal, but again, like there are options to help transition your outdoor cat to a different lifestyle that minimizes bird mortality. Birds do not know what the best sound of a bell is, but there are things called birds be safe collars, and it's basically like a clown collar for your cat. Those have been shown to reduce mortalities 80-90%. So there's lots of things out there and lots of resources people can look into. Again, it's making the decision to take responsibility for.
Emily, thanks for calling in. We're going to go down to Maggie, who's calling from York. Hi, Maggie. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I want to talk about migrations. I love my hummingbirds, the red-throated ones that are here. And I have an Audubon book and a pair of field glasses I was given in fifth grade. I watch birds, and I'm always astounded because I look up. The hummingbirds are there. I have red flowers out. They eat all the time. And it says in one of my books that they leave in my area. It's a certain date, somewhere between the 5th and the 7th of September. But, man, every single year when I go out on that date, there's never a hummingbird there. It's almost like the monarch butterflies. They just, boom, disappear. So do they have this time sensor, or why is this so particular on this date? They just disappear.
So, yeah. Nick, I suspect they're not looking at the calendar on their smartphone.
No, they're not. That app didn't download for them, so they can't do that. No, they, they rely a lot on nectar. And as the fall continues, nectar is in shorter supply. You know, we do not have the same type of flowers that are blooming like we do in the summer. And so they need to get the heck out of here. They're also very small birds and so very susceptible to cold often. And so they are really making sure to get out of here. It's about September 15th is when we start to really see hummingbirds disappear in Maine. And those are our native ruby-throated hummingbirds. The interesting thing, and one thing we get this question all the time at Maine Audubon, is how long should people keep their hummingbird feeders up? You know, most of these ruby throats are around in the middle of September, but like I said earlier, there are other birds that are just messing up their migrations right now. And so hummingbirds from other parts of the country, Rufus, Allens, Calliope, you name it, may show up in Maine later in the season. So we recommend to keep your hummingbird feeders out and stocked, because if one of these very rare hummingbirds shows up, that's a real treat, and they're going to be looking for, you know, some food. And so if you see basically any hummingbird in October, please try to take a picture, send it to me first, and I'll let everybody know. So I'll see it first. But send it to Maine Audubon, because it's very likely a rare species.
Maggie, thanks for the question. Nick, I want to follow up with a few more questions about hummingbirds, if I may. We have some hummingbirds in our garden. They love the red bee balm and other purple and red flowers. But what I've noticed is they sort of have a personality. If I take my laptop outside and I decide to work on the picnic table, I can't tell you how often a hummingbird will hover in front of my face. And I feel like the bird is asking me, who are you and what are you doing here, you know, in my space? What is going on there?
That's probably exactly what they're doing. Hummingbirds are very territorial. They're very feisty birds. If you ever get the opportunity to watch multiple in your yard or at your feeders, they fight each other. They chase each other around constantly. They have a real personality. The other thing I want to mention about hummingbirds that shocks a lot of people is, you know, we all know that they drink nectar. You know, they're specially evolved to drink out of certain flowers, but they're also specially designed for eating insects. A hummingbird's diet is made up of actually more than 70% insects, in large part spiders. The same hovering that allows them to hover in front of a flower and eat it allows them to hover in front of a spider web and pluck a spider off. You know, we all know how important insects are to all of our birds. They're such a good source of nutrition. But even for hummingbirds, birds that we think of as drinking nectar only.
All right. Seth on Facebook writes, I want to plug the Maine Young Birders Club. And our producer, Cindy, mentions that we have had them on the program before. And their mission statement is to provide a safe environment for youth in Maine to experience the wonder of birds and nature with other teens through birding related events and activities, and to promote engagement with our natural world by empowering young Maine residents to study, enjoy birds and birding. So, you know, I'm looking at both of you, Nick and Adrian. Neither one of you are older, but it is sort of a stereotype that birders are older. And the excitement by the Maine Young Birders Club also sort of just flies in the face, pardon the pun, of that stereotype, right?
I love the Maine Young Birders Club. It's hard for young birders. You know, you don't have a car often, or, you know, there aren't a lot of other young birders around. The Maine Young Birders Club is an incredible opportunity for young people who are into birds to find like-minded kids and get out on trips with some awesome leaders. I really wish something like that was around when I was a young birder. And I'm so glad. I know all those folks there. They do an awesome job, and the kids really, really love it. So if you have a youngster in your life who's interested in birding, please get in touch with the Maine Young Birders Club and get it going.
Adrian, earlier in the program, Dan called in from Monhegan Island, which is apparently one of the best spots anywhere to go birding. But, you know, it is a bit of a drive and a ferry ride and a bit of a journey. Where are other spots in Maine that, you know, or maybe within a drive for people who live in Portland or Bangor or Presque Isle to an easy drive to go and enjoy bird watching this time of year?
Oh, thanks, Jen. I get a chance to redeem myself from a couple years ago when I said I wasn't a birder on your show. No, there are. Anyway, you asked a similar question and I didn't have an answer. There are wonderful places all over the state. As Nick mentioned, birds are going to be everywhere, whether it's your own backyard or even so in the Bangor area, for example, where I live, my favorite place to go birding is the Orno Bog Boardwalk, City Forest. Fantastic. In the Portland area, Evergreen Cemetery, for example, anywhere where you have kind of park-like settings and some amount of habitat, the birds are going to be capitalizing on safe places to rest and refuel during migration. So really just getting outside and looking and paying attention, you're going to find birds everywhere right now.
I've been to the Evergreen Cemetery when there's a special bird there, a special owl. And one of the things that's fun about that, and I'm sure it's the same at the Bog Trail, is that birders are really excited to share what they're seeing. So if you don't have knowledge, but you go down to Evergreen Cemetery, you're likely to see someone holding binoculars. And if you say to that person, what are you seeing? They're going to share it with you. They're going to, and chances are they're going to be a PhD ornithologist and tell you everything you need to know about the bird. That's my experience, is that birders are really excited to share. It's maybe the opposite of fly fishermen who don't want to tell you their secret spot. Nick, what's your experience?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, seeing another birder in the wild can sometimes just as rare as seeing a rare bird out there. And so we love to, you know, ask what we've seen, share, you know, point in the direction of a bird that we just saw. It's really fun. I will say too, just to point out some other spots, especially in the fall migration, Maine's coast, and especially all the little finger peninsulas that stick out all over the coast, are great funnels in the fall. So all these birds are migrating south. They don't know where they're going. They don't have a map. And they find themselves, you know, on these peninsulas that stick out all over Maine. That's also why Monhegan is great, because birds fly up, they end up over the ocean and say, I got to find a place to land. So find the island. And so getting out on any of the tips of any of these peninsulas in Maine can be really incredible concentrations of fall migrants. And so check it out.
All right. We're going to go to Trescott and go to David. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hey, hello. Hello. Just two quick comments as I'm actually feeding my birds now, filling my feeders as we speak. It's really important with hummingbirds that people continue to put out the nectar. Just because they disappear now, I have documented the last 2 years hummingbirds at my feeder that come as late as November 11th, and that's down east on the Bold Coast. There's always migratory stragglers desperately looking for nectar. The other thing is put out mealworms in the winter. I have cultivated 5 mating pairs of bluebirds that stay throughout the winter in mid-coast. And because of climate change, our bluebird population is booming.
Oh, David, I love the bluebirds. How many mealworms do you put out?
I've tried the live ones. They love them, but they're a bit of a hassle. I only do like a cup to half a cup at a time, because I don't want them to get rotten and everything. And I really highly recommend getting a feeder that keeps the starlings and whatnot out. So that means the holes that are small enough that really the bluebirds get used to. And I found a beautiful feeder that is online, and it's all plexiglass. So you get to see the bluebirds going in and out and in and out. And they just love this. They love it.
Thanks so much for calling, David. I'm glad you brought up bluebirds. We have, not this summer, Nick, but most summers we have a bluebird box, and it's really fun when the couples raise 2 or 3 broods in one summer. Adrian, are bluebirds considered endangered? What is their status?
Oh, no, bluebirds are not endangered. And as our caller noted, they're actually expanding and becoming more common in Maine, especially throughout the winter. And I was just going to add, related to the hummingbirds, if folks have those late hummingbirds, please also try to, when you report them to Audubon, hopefully it will get to me. The species that Nick mentioned, Rufus, that's a species that breeds in the Arctic. And it's only because of efforts of capturing and banding these birds at people's feeders that we've now identified the species actually migrates routinely through the east. And there's a subpopulation that winters in the southeast US, typically thought to just be the Canadian Rockies. And so that species coming from the Canadian and Alaskan Arctic, as our caller mentioned, seeing birds in November, that species isn't even getting to Maine until later in the season because they're coming from so much farther away. So we really like to try to track those observations.
Okay, David. So if they come this November, you got to call Adrian or Nick or both. Thanks so much for calling in. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're learning about the fall bird migration in Maine. Tell us what you've seen lately. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or comment on Facebook or Instagram. I'm going to go to a Facebook post here. Oh boy, just lost it. Here we go. I'm probably perceived to be a little odd for doing this, but I walk my cats all the time. They used to be outdoor cats before I adopted them, but were quick to pick up on the fact that they get to spend more time with me and be outdoors if they're on the harness. They've also got a more mellow temperament, so they don't startle and take off. My coworkers have been successful at getting their cats to begrudgingly accept leashed outdoor time. And she's got a picture of her darling cat on a leash. So thank you so much for sending that in, Diane. A really, really wonderful picture of your cute cat. Let's see here. We've got a call coming in from Barbara in Harpswell. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead.
Hi. I just had another question about hummingbirds. We've had lived other places and had no trouble, but now wherever we put the pole in the yard, it seems to get spiders on it, and the hummingbirds leave, and I can't keep them off there, and so I stopped putting up the food. So any comments about that are welcome.
Difficult question. So the spiders get up into the hummingbird feeder itself. I have not heard of that particular problem, and I'm sorry that you're experiencing that. There are other styles of hummingbird feeders out there that you could recommend, or I could recommend. You know, some could go on a window or on other parts of the home, or have other sort of poles or setups. That might be an opportunity. And I should say, some callers mentioned it too, the best way to see hummingbirds is on flowers. And so planting the native plants that hummingbirds like to eat from naturally is a great way to attract hummingbirds too. So give that a look as well. But good luck with the spiders.
Yeah, Barbara, our hummingbird feeder broke years ago. And we noticed that they still kept coming because we have lots of flowers in our yard. Adrian.
I was just going to plug Derek and Jeanette Lovich's store in Freeport Wild Bird Supply. Harpswell is not too far. I would definitely recommend stopping by there, and they would be able, it'd be a great resource to help you find some alternative feeders that, like Nick mentioned.
Yeah, and I think that Barbara was also asking, do the spiders scare away the hummingbirds? And Nick, you would say no, they'd eat the spiders, right?
Well, yeah, it depends. I'm not sure which type of spiders we're talking about. You know, there are some spiders we have in Maine that are like as big as hummingbirds, and that scares me and probably scares them as well. and so it's hard to say if they're reacting that way. If they are making it more difficult to get at the food, or if they're altering the nectar or something like that, then that could have an impact. But I haven't seen that particular problem personally.
All right, Barbara, thanks for your question. An email here from Lisa. Can we discuss these new LED lighting CMP communities have been installing? They're supposed to be energy efficient, but they are intrusive and bright. I'm concerned about lights in general, and I can't help but think these really interfere with the birds' migration. So can we talk about how lights affect our songbirds? I would advocate for dark skies in our towns and state for the sake of these birds and the state of our mind. We have done programs on Maine Calling about the dark skies movement, and I see you both nodding. So you would say, yes, 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 please turn off your lights before you go to bed at night and encourage towns to have certain kinds of lights, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, birds, it's incredible to think about the world that birds migrate over, you know, now compared to 150 years ago. They evolved to migrate over a completely dark continent and use the stars to help migrate and have evolved that way. Now the world looks completely different underneath their wings as they're migrating and is filled with lights that confuse them and can really throw them off. You know, the science between lights and birds is very complicated and complex. We know that lights attract birds, especially when there's inclement weather. When birds lose some of the other navigational aids that they may have in the sky, they can be attracted to lights. Birds call to each other as they migrate, as Adrian said, and sometimes, you know, a bird coming in will call others in and attract them down towards the lights. When they're in the lights, which could be a city, then they're more likely to strike windows or become injured in other ways. And so Maine Audubon and many of our partners advocate for turning out lights during migration if you don't need them, and also for adopting types of lights that don't shoot up into the sky, right? That cap lights, keep the light where it's needed onto the ground, and don't have excess light pollution heading into the air.
We have an email here from Wade and Elisa. In addition to your bird timing issue, is our rose-breasted grosbeaks, who have, without fail, for 30 years, arrived the first weekend of May every year. We realize this is an arrival and not a departure like the hummingbirds, but thought you'd be interested in another bird timing story. Adrian, the thing I think is interesting is that we're learning that with climate change, our seasons are changing, and that, you know, it doesn't take a scientist to notice that it's getting warm earlier in the season and staying warm later in the season. But it seems as though that really hasn't affected these birds that we're talking about that have a calendar in their brain.
Yeah, it's a great point, and that's another complicated subject as well. There's a lot of science behind it, as Nick was suggesting. A lot of the drivers that are influencing how and when birds move are, you know, ingrained over centuries and millennia of evolution, and so the pace at which the climate is changing sometimes creates a mismatch with what the birds are actually able to keep up with. And so that can lead to a whole number of problems and sources of challenges for birds. But that's why we're doing great projects like the Bird Atlas that just completed. And, you know, there's a lot of cool stories that have come out of all that work. And I'll just say, keep an eye out, 2026, we're making good progress putting this over 700 page book together about Maine birds, and keep an eye out in 2026 for publication.
Awesome. An email here from Craig. One thing I also love about fall migration is the arrival of our winter seabirds. Three species of scoters, mergansers, loons, long-tailed ducks, grebes, purple sandpipers, and great cormorants. Coastal sea watching in winter is way more diverse and interesting than it is in the summer. Not every bird is leaving us. Some are settling back in for the coming season. Yes, Nick, for some, it's absolutely hard to believe this is the southernmost point in their year.
That's right. This is their sort of summer vacation, winter vacation for a lot of birds who are getting out of even colder places than Maine and coming here. One of them, in addition to all those awesome seabirds, so there's long-tailed ducks, scoters, birds that aren't here for the most part in the summer, come here to hang out on the ocean, simply because it doesn't freeze, right? It's a great place to go to find fish, and it doesn't freeze over. Another one that I always like to point out are loons, right? So loons are famous for being on our lakes and ponds all summer long. They're, you know, an icon of the Maine summer. In the winter, they don't go that far. They just get over to the Gulf of Maine and hang out, sometimes right close to shore or out in the Gulf. And scientists who've tagged loons know that loons that breed in Maine on our lakes and ponds usually also winter in the Gulf of Maine. So these are local birds just moving off the coast. So winter seabirding, if you can get some warm gloves and a cup of coffee, is really rewarding, because there's all kinds of birds you can find that you don't see in the summertime.
Is there a time of day that's good for winter seabirding, or does it really not matter?
Yeah, it depends on what you're looking for. If you're looking for, so dovekie is a small alcid, you know, relative of a puffin that's really sought after. Often they're so small, they're tiny, like the size of your fist. Often earlier in the morning is good for them. You can catch them in flight to their feeding grounds. But otherwise, most anytime during the day, you can see these birds hanging out on the ocean.
I'm going to read a couple fun emails here. This is in response to the conversation earlier about cats and birds. Judy says, I also have a perfect fence in my backyard for cats. With a cat door, my cats go in and out all day. It is wonderful. I've never had a bird caught in the fencing. Please let listeners know how perfect fence is spelled. So it's P-U-R-R-F-E-C-T. And then Dave on Facebook writes, I purchased a cat stroller for my tabby brothers, the boys. I have to get them used to it, but they'll be able to get sunshine and fresh air. And I'm old now, so I won't be embarrassed to be seen. So love that. Just, you know, not even caring about that kind of thing. That's perfect. I'm going to go back to you, Nick, though, because, the you know, one of the things we're learning, people who care about birds, is how the songbird population has been really diminished in the last couple decades. We're learning that we have so many fewer birds out there, also so many fewer insects. And I'm wondering, Maine Calling listeners often want to know what they can do. What do you think people can do to help, you know, obviously, maybe not reverse yep. this, but slow it?
Sure. There's a lot of things you can do, a lot of movements you can become a part of. There's, I'll say, on the local level. So if you want to help out in your backyard and really make a difference, you can plant native plants. Planting native plants is the number one thing you can do to provide native birds the food they need to raise babies. Certain, you know, birds love insects, and a lot of insects don't live on plants that aren't native to Maine. It's just the way that plants and insects work. And so replacing non-native plants with native species, trees, grass, you know, flowers that can give food for native birds is an awesome way to do your small part in your local piece to see the difference. And you can literally see the difference. You'll have birds nesting that you didn't have before. Many of the problems are sort of larger than just one person often. And so thankfully there's lots of movements occurring in Maine and across the country and around the world to try to slow these declines. Climate change has been mentioned a number of times here. Maine Audubon is, you know, plays a proud role on the Maine Climate Council, which is this big group of folks who are working to provide solutions and answers to try to reverse the climate crisis. There's all kinds of pieces to that. Get involved at maineaudubon.org, and we can help you out with pointing you in the right direction. Some of that is supporting additional land conservation in Maine. We're trying to get to 30% of the state conserved. We got about 1.5 million acres to go, and so we need help getting there. Encouraging electrification also works. There's a lot of things. Keeping your cats inside, addressing the windows if you have bird collisions at your home. There's lots of roles we can play on the small and larger scale to do something.
All right, and Adrian wants to send people to the website 3billionbirds.org, and that's the number 3billionbirds.org. We'll squeeze in one more call. We'll go to Sue calling from the Bangor area. Hi, Sue. Go ahead. Sue, are you there? Well, darn. Sorry to miss you, Sue, and we can't have you call back because we're almost at the end of the program. We've talked about songbirds. We've talked about seabirds. What about raptors? Are we going to see anything unusual this time of year? And I'll go back to you, Nick, because Adrian's been such a great trooper with her voice, but I won't make her strain it anymore. What do you expect and when?
Sure. Right now is what I expect. Raptors are a fun migratory species because unlike songbirds, raptors migrate during the day. They take advantage of thermals and they fly during the day. And so you can see them migrate. Maine has some great hawk watches. In the spring, there's a hawk watch at Bradbury Mountain in Pownal. You can still see birds migrating through there in the fall, although there isn't an organizer up there. If you're on Acadia National Park, if you're on the island, MDI, there's a hawk watch that runs there. And it's great to have someone there pointing out the migrants that come over. That could be broadwing hawks, bald eagles, golden eagles, if you're lucky, you name it. Everything's heading out now. So watch for raptors moving over September and October for sure.
Okay. And Adrian wants us to mention on October 9th, a Zoom presentation on Forum on Wildlife Safe Rodent Control in New England. We'll put information about that on our Facebook page. You know, maybe yet another reason not to put out poisons, correct, for the rodents that you're trying to control in your property, not just because neighborhood animals might get after those rodents or coyotes or something like that, but also because raptors. Thank you so much, all of you, both of you, for being on Maine Calling today. Nick Lund with Maine Audubon, who runs the Bird Safe program and writes the blog The Birdist, and Adrian Leppold, wildlife biologist with Maine Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, director of the Maine Bird Atlas, which has been in the works for years and is set to come out in 2026. Today's sound engineer, Sam Tracy. Our theme song was composed by Mike Jandro. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Some information: if you want to subscribe to our weekly newsletter, go to mainecalling.org. If you would like to leave us a comment at any time, go to download the Maine Public Vox Pop app. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.